supposed to make me feel better? That the people who bullied you didn't get what they deserved? It's meant to show you that these people don't matter, Henry. Their successes and failures mean nothing to me. I am exactly who I want to be, doing exactly what I want to do. After graduation, the people who torment you will disappear, and they'll never have the power to hurt you again. When I tell you it gets better, this is what I mean.
I guess it's just hard to believe that right now, I said. Miss Ferraci closed the yearbook and smiled.
And one day you'll wake up, look around, and wonder how you could ever have believed otherwise. If the world doesn't end, of course.
Thanks, Miss Ferraci. I was in a hurry to get to lunch. Diego had texted me to find out where I was, and I was busy typing a reply instead of paying attention to what was in front of me. I turned the corner out of the science building, and pain exploded in my face. The suddenness of it paralyzed me. It felt like I'd been hit by a brick instead of a fist. The force of the blow knocked me into the wall, and I banged my head, the pain of the collision spreading through my skull like ripples on a pond.
"Rotten hell, space boy!"
A large figure in my blurry vision darted past me, leaden footsteps pounding down the hall. I didn't need to see his face. I'd heard Adrian's voice in my nightmares often enough to recognize it. Mr. Curtis poked his head out of his classroom.
"What's going on out here, Mr. Denton?"
I leaned against the wall and held my hand over my throbbing, watery eye.
"Nothing, sir."
Diego punched the steering wheel so hard the dashboard shook.
"I'll fucking kill him."
I'd skipped lunch to avoid Diego seeing my eye, but he found me after last period. We'd been sitting in the school parking lot for 10 minutes while he raged, blaming himself for not being there to protect me.
"I'll rip his fucking hands off."
"Calm down, Diego. It's not a big deal." It was difficult to sell it with a swollen eye and a plum-colored bruise running across the bridge of my nose.
"It's a big fucking deal," Diego yelled. "Which one of them was it? Was it Marcus?"
"No."
"Don't protect him."
I flinched. The air around Diego vibrated the way it does before a thunderstorm, warning me that worse was coming.
"Stop, Diego. Just stop. It doesn't matter who did it."
Diego clenched his fist. He punched the steering wheel until his knuckles bled.
"Don't you get it, Henry? I love you. I love you so much, and I know this is all a big joke to you because the world is ending, and you don't think any of this matters, but when it comes to you, it always matters."
I unbuckled my seatbelt and twisted around. I held Diego's face in my hands and kissed him despite the agony that exploded around my nose and eye. Pain has a way of reinforcing memories. It binds them to the moment so you never forget, and I didn't want to forget.
I think I love you too, Diego.
The words hurt. Saying them to someone other than Jesse, but I knew they were true, and that made them hurt even worse.
"But that's why we shouldn't see each other."
I don't remember when I started crying, but I couldn't stop.
"I wish the Sluggers had chosen you to save the world. I can't be the reason you end up back in juvie."
Diego was shaking, but I couldn't tell if he was crying or going to punch me.
"I don't need you to look after me. You can't even look after yourself."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"You won't press the button to save the world because you don't think you deserve to live in it."
"I was going to do it, Diego. Because of you."
Diego shook his head.
"Maybe you're right. We shouldn't see each other."
He laughed bitterly, but I didn't get the joke.
"I wanted you to press the button because you wanted to, not for me or anyone else. If you can't see how amazing you are, then forget it."
I tried to think of something more to say, but I'd run out of words. I got out of the car and walked back toward school to call Audrey for a ride. I half expected Diego to chase after me, but he didn't. Superbugs. The first case of untreatable gonorrhea is observed in Max Costanza of Warwick, Rhode Island. It is estimated that he infected 13 sexual partners before being diagnosed. Within months, outbreaks of antibiotic-resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa, Clostridium difficile, and E. coli are observed in patients around the world. Not even last-resort antibiotics are effective in controlling the diseases. Governments around the globe direct their resources to the development of new antibiotics. As deaths from simple infections rise dramatically, a new sense of teamwork spreads throughout the world. Knowledge is shared freely. Old barriers are eliminated as humanity races to find cures for diseases once considered beaten. Economic and military rivalries are set aside to save the world. An unparalleled level of global collaboration leads to the first breakthrough nearly 2 years after Max Costanza's initial diagnosis. The potential new antibiotic is found in the chemical secretions of cockroaches. While attempting to isolate enough of the compounds in the cockroaches, an international consortium of scientists develops revolutionary technologies to increase the size of the cockroaches through genetic manipulation. These novel insects, named Blatella asmithicus, after the geneticist responsible for creating them, Dr. Andrew Smith, measure nearly a meter in length, and have an astounding resiliency and immunity to all known toxins, capable even of withstanding significant exposure to radiation. They are more commonly referred to as chromes, cockroaches of mighty size. The first new successful antibiotic in a decade is tested on 8 January 2016. Within days, the mortality rate from bacterial infections decreases to levels never before achieved. United by their cause, a new age of peace and prosperity envelops the world. It is the golden age of humanity. On 29 January 2016, a pair of chromes escape from a laboratory in Austin, Texas. They begin to breed. As a result of their increased size, chromes possess a ravenous appetite and devour everything in their path. Austin is overrun in 3 days, Texas in 2 weeks, the United States in less than a year. When chromes are the only living creatures remaining on the planet, they consume each other. 7 January, 2016. After Adrian punched me in the hallway at school, which I read on Marcus's snowflake page was retribution for his expulsion, despite not even being the one who'd emailed his video confession to Principal DeShields, I spent most of my free time in my room, contemplating my existence. I've been wondering why the sluggers haven't abducted me since Thanksgiving. They've had plenty of opportunities, and there were definitely a few times I might have pressed the button. Maybe they don't want Earth saved after all. Maybe they're messing with my head. They want to see if I'll break under the pressure. Maybe the world isn't going to end, and I'll spend January 29 waiting for an apocalypse that won't come. Diego sent me a couple of texts, left some messages, but I deleted them unanswered and unread. I'm not sure I did the right thing, breaking up with him. I'm not sure we were ever actually a couple. I'd seen him naked, and he'd seen me, so we were more than friends. I just don't know what more actually means. I wasn't kidding when I told him I loved him. Somewhere between his bursting into my chemistry class and punching his knuckles bloody on his steering wheel, I fell in love with Diego Vega. As human beings, we seek meaning in everything. We're so good at discovering patterns that we see them where they don't exist. One summer, my parents sent me and Charlie to stay with our Uncle Joe in Seattle. I had to share a room with Charlie, and his snoring kept me from sleeping. Uncle Joe gave me a white noise machine. When it was time for bed, I fired it up and listened to the static. It was nice at first, like crumpling paper or a fly's endlessly buzzing wings. But after a while, I began to hear things in the noise. Random words or bits of music repeating. I woke up Charlie and made him listen, convinced I'd discovered a secret message left by spies. But he punched me and went back to sleep. Once I heard the pattern, I couldn't stop hearing it, and I spent the rest of the summer looking and listening for patterns in other random sources. The wind, clothes tumbling in the dryer. I even pulled out one of Uncle Joe's old television sets to watch the snow. We look for the same patterns in our lives to give them meaning. When someone says, everything happens for a reason, they're trying to convince you there's a pattern to your life, and that if you pay close attention, it's possible to decipher it. If my mom hadn't packed my lunch on 18 September 2013, I wouldn't have gone to the cafeteria early and sat at a table that belonged to a group of seniors, which included my brother. Charlie wouldn't have stolen my lunch, and I wouldn't have been forced to buy something to eat and sit at another table on the other side of the cafeteria.
Jesse never would have seen me, and we wouldn't have met. We wouldn't have dated, fallen in love, and Jesse's suicide wouldn't have destroyed me. I wouldn't have gone to the boys' room to cry and run into Marcus on his way out. Marcus and I wouldn't have started fooling around, and I wouldn't have gone to his party to prove that I could. I wouldn't have bumped into Diego and gotten to know him, and we wouldn't have fallen for each other. A person who believed in patterns might be tempted to believe Diego and I were fated to meet. Only it wasn't fate. It wasn't destiny. And it certainly wasn't God. It was chance. A random series of events given meaning by someone desperate to prove there's a design to our lives. That the minutes and hours between our birth and death are more than frantic moments of chaos. Because if that's all they are, if there are no rules governing our lives, then our entire existence is a meaningless farce. If Jesse didn't have a reason for hanging himself, then his death was pointless. And if Jesse died for nothing, how can I live for anything?
The doorbell rang, but I didn't move. Mom was somewhere in the house. She could answer the door. I was inert, still in my school clothes, lying on top of my sheets, dozing in a transitory space between asleep and awake. My skin was moist, but I was too lazy to crank up the fan. I must have drifted off because I didn't hear my mom calling my name until she was standing over my bed shaking me.
Henry, wake up.
What?
There's someone here to see you.
She hesitated in a way that made me think it was Diego. I hadn't told her we'd broken up or whatever, but she wasn't stupid either.
I'll be out in a minute.
Mom left. I got a whiff of my pits, slapped on some deodorant, and changed into something less pungent. I wasn't sure what was left to say to Diego. Nothing had changed. If he stayed with me, he'd end up hurting someone, and I didn't want him to spend the last days of Earth behind bars. But I missed him. I missed his goofy smile and his stupid jokes, and how he blushed when his stomach gurgled. I wasn't sure if I could see him and hang on to my resolve. As it turned out, I didn't have to worry. Mrs. Franklin sat at the dining room table with my mom. She looked out of place in our house, like finding a Van Gogh displayed amongst an army of Thomas Kincaids. Even dressed in a simple outfit of shorts and a blouse, she radiated refinement, a crispness that my mother in her shabby clothes could never match. I thought she must have come to confront me about breaking into her house, and that cops would surely be busting down my door any moment, but I resisted the urge to panic. If police were on their way, freaking out wouldn't help.
"Hi, Mrs. Franklin."
She turned toward me, the bare hint of a smile on her lips.
"Henry, I can't believe that for as long as you and Jesse dated, I've never met your mother."
"Lucky you." Mom scowled at me. "You know, I have a box of baby pictures around here somewhere. Keep it up, mister." She pushed back her chair.
"It was really nice to meet you, Helen. We should have lunch sometime."
"Absolutely."
She waited for Mom to disappear outside before motioning for me to sit. When I did, she stared at me for so long that I began to feel the same way I did when the sluggers examined me.
"I never liked you, Henry."
Mrs. Franklin's pronouncement should have shocked me, but it didn't.
"Thanks?"
The hard edges of her face softened momentarily.
"It wasn't you. I'm sure you're a fine young man."
I noticed the way she lingered on my black eye, and wasn't sure I believed her.
"It was Jesse. I wanted him to focus on his studies. You were a distraction."
"Jesse would have been valedictorian if..."
"I'm glad he found you, though. You made him happy."
Mrs. Franklin's voice was wooden, like she was reciting lines, but I didn't know whether it was because she was insincere, or because if she allowed any emotion to creep into her voice, she'd fall apart.
"About the other night," Mrs. Franklin held up her hand. "I think I understand."
"You do?"
"No, I suppose not. But I'm sure you had your reasons."
"You turned Jesse's bedroom into a sewing room."
"I'd burn down that house if I had the nerve."
Mrs. Franklin's composure cracked. A mad giggle escaped from her mouth, and she seemed as surprised by it as I was.
"Jesse is imprinted all over that house. Down every hallway, in every wall. He's gone, but he'll never be gone." I considered taking her hand, offering her comfort. But if that was what she wanted, there had been plenty of opportunities after Jesse's death. His funeral, the wake, the lonely days after, when even eating had become an unbearable chore. "Why are you here?" Mrs. Franklin cleared her throat. "We didn't speak at Jesse's funeral. I was too bound up in my own grief to be concerned with yours. I hope you can forgive me." "There's nothing to forgive." "I wanted to ask you. I wanted to know. Did Jesse tell you he was sad?" The question blindsided me the same way Jesse's suicide had. No more so than anyone else. "Did he ever talk about wanting to hurt himself?" "Not with me," I said. "Audrey knew a little, but he kept that part of himself from me." For some reason, that made Mrs. Franklin smile. So like Jesse. He hated to be a bother and only wanted to make people smile. Especially you. He did. I don't think I was ever happier than with Jesse. Neither was I. Mrs. Franklin folded her hands in front of her, and I think we both got a little lost, remembering how amazing Jesse was. The way the sun shone brighter, and no trouble seemed to matter when he was near. Do you think it was my fault? I don't know. It probably wasn't the answer Mrs. Franklin hoped for, but it was honest, and she deserved the truth. Maybe. Maybe it was my fault. Maybe nobody is to blame. My son was very lucky to have had you in his life. Mrs. Franklin pushed back her chair and stood. She was even more imposing, towering over me. Please don't break into my house again. Yes, ma'am. As she turned to leave, I stopped her. Did you find anything when you were cleaning out Jesse's room? Mrs. Franklin furrowed her brow. Like what, Henry? I don't know. Anything that might have explained why he killed himself? The whole time we were talking, I kept hoping she'd reveal that she'd discovered a letter addressed to me, something Jesse had left behind that would make sense of everything. She shook her head, eyes downcast. What would it have changed if I had? At least we would have known. But knowing wouldn't return Jesse to us. She began to head toward the door again. I'd broken into her house looking for closure, and I think she came to mine looking for the same. I'm not sure either of us found what we were looking for, but maybe continuing to search was the best we could do. Mrs. Franklin? She sighed. Yes, Henry. If you knew the world was going to end, but you had the power to stop it, would you? Yes. Why? Mrs. Franklin's back was to me, but I imagined I could see the determined set of her jaw, the same resolute expression I'd seen on Jesse's face 100 times. Because Jesse believed that life wasn't worth living, and I refused to prove him right.
10 January, 2016. I was having a dream. The sluggers abducted me and cut off my limbs. Then they reattached them wrong. My left arm became my right leg, my right leg became my left leg, and so on. Then they tossed me onto the floor and forced me to try to crawl to the button. I wanted to reach the button more than anything, but it was impossible to walk with an arm where my leg should have been. Jesse was in the dream, too. He was lecturing me on the impermanence of memory. Most of the words jumbled together because I was busy having my body parts rearranged, but I remembered him telling me that memories are often amalgams of truth and fiction, sewn together in our heads by our subconscious to support our personal beliefs about the world. He droned on and on about dendrites and voltage gradients, but in my dream I couldn't stop wondering how much of what I remembered about Jesse was truth and how much was fiction. As the aliens prepared to switch my hands, feet, and genitals, I heard a banging from the shadows. The sluggers turned as a unit to look toward the source of the noise, but Jesse hadn't noticed and was still talking about memory, this time in rhyming couplets. He might have also been speaking Italian. Apparently, I am also an Italian poet in my dreams. The banging grew louder and I tried to sit up, but lacking limbs I fell off the table instead. My last thought before I hit the ground and woke up was, "Not the nose!"
The pounding sound traveled with me out of my dream, but I was groggy and confused, so it took me a moment to realize someone was knocking on my window. It was 1:37 a.m. Who the fuck was knocking on my bedroom window at 1:37? I lifted the window a crack.
What?
Bro, I lost my keys. Let me in.
Charlie slurred his words, barely able to form a coherent sentence. Luckily, I'd been speaking Charlie Denton my entire life.
Do you know what time it is?
Charlie was too busy puking to answer. I threw on some clothes and snuck through the house to avoid waking Mom. Charlie wasn't waiting by the door, and I was shocked by a blast of Arctic air when I walked outside in nothing but shorts and a tank top.
Shit.
Charlie's car was parked on the front lawn. The headlights illuminated the front of the house, and the hazards were blinking.
You've got to be kidding me.
The keys were in the ignition, so I quickly backed the Jeep into the street and parked behind Mom. I couldn't do anything about the tire tracks marring the grass. Mom was going to strangle Charlie when she saw them. Charlie stumbled toward me. The front of his work shirt was crusty with vomit, and he was sweating profusely, even in the cold.
Jesus, Charlie, we have to get you inside.
When did I eat broccoli?
He lurched and opened his mouth. I thought he was going to throw up again, but he fired off a wet burp that made my skin crawl.
Better.
Where's Zoe?
Parents' house.
It's been nearly 2 weeks since Zoe's loss, and I haven't seen much of her or Charlie. Their obstetrician suspects the baby suffered from chromosomal damage. Mom told me those types of pregnancies frequently miscarry early on, but not always. Only Mom didn't use the word miscarry. She referred to it as nature's failsafe, as if that could draw the poison from the sting. I didn't have the heart to tell her that with Zoe so far along, the correct term was actually stillbirth. Anyway, it doesn't matter what word we use. Their baby is dead.
You reek, I said. Let's get you washed up.
Charlie didn't put up a fight when I let him inside and got him out of his work clothes, which probably needed to be burned. He stood compliantly under the shower, letting the water run over his head. I turned it up as hot as he could bear to warm his bones so he didn't get sick. I had no idea how long he'd been outside my window, but his skin was icy. When we ran out of hot water, Charlie dressed and followed me to his room. His eyes were bloodshot, and he was sweating cheap booze.
Don't go anywhere.
I left Charlie sitting on his bed while I ran to the kitchen for water and aspirin to mitigate his inevitable hangover. I heard the first crash as I was filling the glass and ran back to Charlie's room. He'd knocked over the crib, spilling out the mound of stuffed animals within, and I couldn't get to him before he punched a hole in Diego's mural.
Charlie, what the fuck are you doing?
I tried to tackle him before he hurt himself, but he lunged at me. His fist glanced off my shoulder. I wrestled for his arms, but Charlie was bigger and stronger than I was, and the alcohol flooding his body amplified his rage. He punched me in the stomach, knocking the breath from me, and followed it with a knee to my groin that dropped me to the floor. Before I knew it, Charlie was straddling me, punching my ribs and my arms. All I could do was protect my face and plead for him to stop. The blows slacked off, and Charlie staggered to the rocking chair. He collapsed into it, sobbing.
Evie Nicole Denton.
Charlie repeated the name over and over. My entire body hurt. Every breath felt like I had rusty fishhooks for lungs, but I crawled toward my brother.
When was the last time you slept, Charlie?
He looked at me like it was the first time he'd really seen me all night.
She had a name. We gave her a fucking name.
It's a beautiful name.
She was tiny, Henry. Littler than my hand.
Charlie's body shook. He pulled his knees to his chest and buried his face in them. When Jesse died, people said a lot of things to try to make me feel better. He's in a better place. At least he's not in pain anymore. God has a plan. Bullshit platitudes that made me want to rip their faces off. Even Mom tried to tell me that everything happened for a reason. The only person who didn't was Charlie. After the funeral, he told me that Jesse Franklin was an asshole and I was better off with him dead. I decked Charlie on our front lawn, split his goddamn lip. My second punch left him with a black eye that lingered for 2 weeks. It was the only fight with my brother I ever won. You need to hit me some more? I asked. I think I've still got some unbruised ribs on my left side.
Charlie sneered. Such a fucking pansy.
We'll see who's a pansy when Mom rips you a new asshole for driving home drunk and tearing up the lawn.
Whatever.
You could have killed yourself, idiot. That was the point.
I hugged my ribs, breathing shallowly. At least he hadn't hit my face. My eye was only just healed from Adrian's surprise punch in the hallway at school. Don't bother, I said. Unless the aliens abduct me again, we're all going to die in a couple of weeks.
Charlie glanced at me. Do you honestly believe that shit? Did you think I was making it up? I always figured you belonged in a mental hospital. Maybe I do.
Charlie's eyelids began to droop, and his breathing slowed. I should have left him to sleep in the chair. It would have served him right to wake up at least half as sore as I was going to. But I grabbed his wrist and helped him to his bed. He crashed into the pillows, asleep before he hit them.
I really wanted to be a dad, he mumbled.
I pulled the blankets over Charlie and set his phone beside him before turning off the lights. I stood in the doorway, listening to my brother snore. For the record, I think he would have been a good dad. I stood at the edge of the ocean, letting the water wash over my feet. My eyes were closed, but I was looking up, and I swore I could still see the stars through my eyelids. On my left was mighty Hercules, and on my right, Mars and the constellation Libra. Somewhere out there, the sluggers were orbiting Earth in their spaceship.
I don't know if you can hear me, but I'm ready to press the button now.
The air was still. There was no moon and no shadows.
I want to press the button.
I shivered uncontrollably, but figured it was my due to suffer for this. If I'd pushed that button when I'd had the chance, I wouldn't have needed to stand outside in the cold night, begging the aliens to save me. Only it wasn't myself I wanted to save. It was my brother who wanted to be a father, and Zoe who deserved to finish college. It was Mom and Nana and Audrey and Diego. Even Marcus. They deserve to live, even if I don't. Please.
15 January, 2016. The Big Bang released so much energy that the universe has been expanding outward from it for more than 13 billion years. Eventually, that expansion will cease, and gravity will cause the universe to contract. All those galactic clusters and far-flung stars ringed by planets, some dead, some teeming with alien life, are going to come zipping back toward one another, faster and faster as the pull of gravity draws them toward the center. No one is sure what will happen in the big crunch. The universe and everything in it could collapse into a massive singularity, or it could initiate another big bang, a new beginning to the universe. Maybe that wouldn't be such a bad thing. Maybe the only way to really start over is to tear everything apart. At least that's what I told myself. Mom was cooking when I walked into the kitchen, buzzing about, happier than I'd seen her in ages. Audrey was picking me up to go to Calypso High's winter carnival in 15 minutes. I had no real desire to waste my time throwing balls at bottles to win cheap prizes, but Audrey refused to let me spend another Friday night wallowing alone in my room. I tried to ignore the possibility that Diego might be there, but when I realized I'd spent an hour obsessing over what to wear, I knew I was hoping to see him.
"Smells good in here," I said. There were so many aromas it was difficult to separate them, but I was pretty certain one was fish. "Pancetta-wrapped salmon with asparagus and lime creme fraiche."
She glanced at me over her shoulder as she stood at the sink washing asparagus.
"You look nice."
I peeked at the bowls on the counter, looking for something to nibble on, but none of it looked edible.
"Audrey and I are going to the winter carnival." "That'll be fun."
She sounded doubtful, and I was right there with her.
"Sadly, I have nothing better to do."
I settled on a banana. It was still too green, but I had to quiet my chatty stomach.
"You seen Charlie?"
Mom shook her head.
"I think he's staying with Zoe at her parents' house."
Charlie and I hadn't spoken since the other night. My ribs looked like a weather map predicting a winter storm, but I'll count it a worthy sacrifice if Charlie never drives drunk again.
You think they'll get through this?
Mom transferred the asparagus to the cutting board. She smiled as she chopped. I hadn't seen her smoke since New Year's either, but I didn't mention it. She'd tried to quit before, but had never lasted longer than a week. I hoped she succeeded, but I didn't want her to feel like a failure if she didn't.
It's hard to tell.
I like Zoe, I said. I like Charlie with Zoe. It didn't matter that Charlie didn't deserve his beautiful, brilliant fiancée. For some unknown reason, she loved him, and he was a better person for it.
Me too.
Even Mom seemed surprised that she meant it. Though I do hope your brother changes his mind about college. I chuckled. Fat chance.
Can't blame a mom for dreaming.
She set to work descaling the salmon. I've never been able to get past the meaty pink of it, so similar to human flesh, the white stripes of fat running through it.
Are you having someone for dinner?
She shook her head.
Just experimenting for the restaurant.
How's it going?
Good, I think.
Mom leaned forward and made a face.
Henry, will you scratch my forehead?
She held up her fishy hands. Mom arched her back like a cat when I finally hit the itch.
Better?
Much.
You seem happier.
I guess I am, Mom said after thinking about it for a moment.
It's tough work, and Chef Norbert can be a real asshole.
Nice way to talk about your new boss. She rolled her eyes.
What? His only mode of speaking is yelling, and sometimes he barks orders in French, and I have no idea what he's saying.
Mom laughed, and I couldn't help thinking there hadn't been enough of that in our house this last year.
Maybe I'll open my own restaurant one day.
I cringed at the idea of Mom running her own place, stress-smoking and screaming at the help, but there were worse dreams to have.
Well, someone ought to put Charlie's college fund to use.
Good thinking. I watched Mom while I waited for Audrey. She chopped and mixed and moved so quickly that I couldn't always follow what she was doing, but every action was confident. Cooking is practically magic to me, and my mom is a wizard.
Mom, did Dad leave because of me?
She froze. The knife hovered over the cutting board, and her eyebrows dipped to form a V.
Why on earth would you think that?
Lots of reasons.
Henry, sweetie, your father loved you.
I know.
You aren't the reason he left.
Why then? Mom sighed and set down her knife. She moved more slowly, like she'd been waiting years for me to ask, and now that I had, she realized she wasn't prepared to answer.
Your father and I fell out of love. Joel was never the marrying type, and I was naive, in love with the idea of love. His devotion to you and Charlie is the reason he stayed as long as he did.
If he loved us so much, why'd he abandon us?
Because he hated the person he was becoming, and he wanted to leave before you and your brother hated him too.
My memories of my father are all jumbled together. They say when we recall a memory, we're actually calling up the last time we remembered it, and I'm not sure I can trust that my anger at him for leaving hasn't tainted those memories. I tried to think back to the last few months he lived with us. Had he been stressed? More distant? If he'd stayed, would my life have turned out differently? Would I hate him more than I hated him for leaving us?
Do you think Dad made the right choice?
Mom resumed chopping at a leisurely pace.
I don't know, sweetie, but I think we're doing pretty well without him. Everything happens for a reason.
The Calypso High Winter Carnival was held in the school's senior parking lot. Gone were the cars and neatly lined spaces, replaced by game booths and food booths and a Ferris wheel that looked like it had barely passed its last safety inspection. The cold weather had stuck around, but the heat from the bonfire and the press of bodies made me wish I'd worn shorts rather than jeans and a button-down shirt. Audrey spent the drive describing her mother's next invention, an office chair that grew more uncomfortable the longer you sat in it. It was supposed to remind cubicle workers to stand and stretch every hour, but it sounded like an ergonomic torture device. I did my best to camouflage my anxiety by singing along to the stupid songs on the radio. I wasn't thrilled with the idea of spending the evening surrounded by my peers,
most of whom I imagined whispering Space Boy as they passed. There were too many dark corners to hide in, too many shadows to launch punches from. Still, I tried to enjoy myself. We ran from booth to booth looking for trouble. I made a valiant effort to win a stuffed whale by pitching a ball at a pyramid of bottles, but never managed to knock down more than two. Audrey, however, had perfect aim and dunked J.O. into a tank of freezing water. Seeing him shiver and sputter wasn't exactly revenge, but it didn't suck either. Somewhere along the way, my fake smile became real. I was with my best friend, and no one could hurt me. I didn't even mind when she had to leave to work the debate team's booth. For $2, they'd try to help you win any argument. I wandered through the maze of booths and tents, thinking how much Jesse would have adored the spectacle of it all. He loved anything loud and manic. The laughter and smiles of crowds had given him strength, whereas they drained me even when I enjoyed them. The Calypso crooners were hosting a karaoke booth, and I couldn't listen to one more off-key rendition of Summer Nights, so I ended up on the far side of the carnival, where it was quieter. I noticed a blue-striped tent with a meticulously painted sign that read, Calypso High Art Gallery. Diego had mentioned an art show, and I wondered if any of his paintings were on display. I had 30 minutes to kill before Audrey rejoined me, so I decided to take a peek inside. The outside of the tent may have been dingy, but the inside was wondrous. Framed art hung from the walls and was displayed on freestanding easels. A sculpture of Medusa that bore an eerie resemblance to Principal de Shields haunted a space by the entrance, glowering at all who passed. A cityscape constructed of cigarette butts had attracted a crowd of admirers, and a painting of an ocean sunrise caught my attention. It was so realistic I could hear the waves and smell the salt water. Each piece of art had a little placard indicating the artist and name of the work. I didn't want to admit I was looking for one bearing Diego's name, but I was. I finally found it in the back of the tent, beside an 8x10 painting in a simple black frame. Diego had painted a boy sitting cross-legged in a dark room. He was naked, with shadows for underwear and cracked cement for skin. Sections of his arms, legs, and shoulders had crumbled, revealing a core of rebar rather than bone. As if hinged, the boy's skull hung open, and the hollow space inside was crowded with familiar faces. I recognized my mom, Nana, Charlie, and Zoe cradling a tiny bundle between them, Ms. Ferraci and Audrey. Jesse's translucent face peered back at me, too. It took me a moment to notice, but hidden in the back stood an algae-skinned alien with marble-black eyes mounted on wobbly stalks. The boy's hand hovered over a button, and his lips bore a cheeky Mona Lisa smile, as if he were hoarding all the secrets of the universe and would never share. It was me. I tried to digest the details, but there were so many. Rather than beating in my chest, Diego had painted my heart as cut from the night sky, full of stars, and pinned to the concrete skin of my upper left arm, and a crow hovered overhead, so dark it nearly blended into the background. I could have peeled back the layers of meaning for hours and not discovered them all. This was how Diego saw me. I was Henry Denton, and I was Space Boy. I was broken, and I was beautiful. I was nothing, and I was everything. I didn't matter to the universe, but I mattered to him. The person in that painting would have pressed the button. The person in that painting with the steel bones and legions in his skull would have saved Jesse. The person in that painting would have fought back in the showers. He would have told the police who had attacked him. The person in that painting wasn't real. An average-sized human being jumping out of an airplane will reach 99% of terminal velocity, approximately 122 miles per hour, within about 15 seconds. If the body remains horizontal, the air resistance gives the illusion of floating. That's how I felt since meeting Diego, like I was floating, but I'd been falling the entire time. A hand on my shoulder. Henry? Diego. Henry, are you... That's not me. Diego's hand slid away. The ground was rushing to meet me. I was falling and falling. I was running. But I could never run far or fast enough to escape the impact because gravity is inevitable. Vega is the brightest star in the constellation Lyra, and the third brightest star in the northern hemisphere. Lyra is traditionally associated with the Greek musician Orpheus, though it is also sometimes referred to as King Arthur's harp. Upon the death of Orpheus's wife, Eurydice, he marched into the underworld and played his lyre for Hades, until the Lord of Death, so moved, agreed to return his wife. The hitch was that Orpheus was forbidden from looking backward until he was clear of the dread god's domain. Failure to abide by this one rule would nullify his victory, and Eurydice would be lost forever. Orpheus looked back. Orpheus was an asshole. I, however, did not look back, not even once I reached the football field. I sat on the bleachers and buried my face in my hands, crying until I couldn't cry anymore, wondering how I'd fucked everything up. I wasn't the person Diego thought I was. I could never be that person. I hadn't even pressed the goddamn button. I screamed as loud as I could, letting the noise explode from my throat and ripple across the world. I didn't care who heard me.
You don't answer my texts anymore, space boy.
Marcus startled me when he sauntered up behind me. I hopped to my feet and scanned the surrounding area for Adrian or Jay, but either they were well hidden or Marcus was alone. Go away. Marcus climbed the bleachers and sat next to where I was standing, leaving space between us. His face was drawn and pale, but he still looked good in jeans and a V-neck sweater.
Listen, about that thing in the hallway, that wasn't me. I didn't know about that.
I touched my eye involuntarily.
Whatever, Marcus. I'm not in the mood.
I marched down off the bleachers toward the football field, hoping he wouldn't follow me. But he did. I turned around and shouted, "Leave me alone!"
I miss spending time with you, Henry.
Publicly humiliating and attacking me was a bizarre way to show it. A box of chocolates might have been more appropriate.
I'm sorry.
The funny thing is that I believed him. Jesse had faked being happy. Diego had hidden his past from me. But Marcus had always told me the truth. Even when he beat me up, it was honest. He pulled a flask from his pocket and offered it to me. When I didn't take it, he drank from it first and offered it to me again. Drinking was the last thing I needed, but I didn't want to feel anything anymore, so I accepted the flask. I don't know what it was, but it burned my throat. I sat down on the grass and buried my face in my hands.
Why are you being so nice to me, Marcus? Why now? You want to know the truth?
He passed me the flask again, and I swallowed a couple of gulps, feeling the alcohol loosen my limbs and my brain.
Sure.
I was only half listening. I could still hear the distant sounds of the carnival, but it occurred to me how isolated we were. Marcus sat across from me and pulled his feet in so he was sitting cross-legged.
I'm not strong like you, Henry. My parents expect me to be their perfect son. My friends expect me to be Mr. Popular. It's so hard to be everything to everyone. I feel stretched thin sometimes. You're the only person who doesn't expect anything from me.
I sat up and tried to clear my head, but my thoughts were stuck in a pool of tar and I couldn't pull them out.
You're drunk. You don't know what you're saying.
Marcus sat forward. His eyes were unfocused and red.
I knew in the beginning I was just not Jesse to you. You needed someone to take your mind off of Jesse, and I was not Jesse. But I fell for you, Henry, and I thought you'd fall for me, too.
You attacked me. Marcus crawled across the grass until his face was so close to mine that I could smell his rancid breath.
I fucked up.
Marcus brushed my lips with his, and I didn't turn away.
Is this all right?
Here was Marcus offering to be not Jesse for me again. All I had to do was accept, and I could blunt the pain of living for a little while longer. I looked at the stars, wishing the sluggers would abduct me so that I didn't have to make a choice. That's what this was all about, after all. Making choices. Diego had made a choice. My mom had made a choice. Charlie had made a choice. Even Jesse had made a choice. It had been a selfish, stupid, heartbreaking choice, but one he'd made for himself. Marcus pushed himself onto me. The weight of his body against mine made it difficult to breathe. A rock dug into my back while Marcus kissed my neck, his hands pulling at the button on my jeans.
I didn't have to choose.
I could close my eyes and let it happen the same way I was going to sit back and let the world end. Marcus rubbed his hips against mine and struggled with my zipper. I didn't have to choose. It was easier not to choose. I can't.
What's wrong?
Marcus cupped my head with his hand and stroked the side of my face with his thumb, kissing me hard, desperately. Stop! I wedged my hands between our chests and tried to shove Marcus away. I don't want to do this, Marcus. Marcus stopped kissing me.
You're a fucking tease, Henry.
Get off of me! Marcus grabbed a handful of my hair and slammed my head into the ground. The world melted and blurred. There were so many stars, too many. There shouldn't have been that many stars in the sky. I tried to name them, but they were constellations I'd never seen. Torpid from the booze and dizzy from hitting the rock, I tried to fend off Marcus, but he was yanking my jeans down around my knees. This was another slugger hallucination. Only an hour ago, I was laughing with Audrey. I was seeing myself the way Diego saw me. Somewhere along the way, I'd stumbled into this nightmare world where Marcus was on top of me, panting in my ear and telling me what a fucking loser I was, how he was gonna fuck Space Boy, and no one would believe me because no one believed loser Space Boys. I pressed my head against the rock, digging it deeper into the cut on my scalp, clutching the pain, using it to drag me out of the fog. I elbowed Marcus in the face and scrambled to my feet, pulling up my pants and sprinting toward the flashing lights and laughter and nauseating smell of popcorn. Marcus screamed my name. He tackled me by the bleachers and I fell on my wrist. It bent back in a way wrists weren't supposed to bend, but I ate the pain, swallowed it down with blood and became stronger. I kicked like an animal until I connected with something that made him howl, and then I ran again. I didn't look back this time either. I spotted Mrs. Ferraci standing by the candy apple booth.
Henry?
Mrs. Ferraci dropped her apple and brushed my hair from my eyes. It was sticky with blood. The color drained from her face.
Henry, what happened?
Now that I was safe, I finally looked back. Marcus wasn't there, but Diego was. He trotted toward us, panic in his algae eyes.
Henry, I've been looking for you everywhere.
He saw me, cradling my wrist, touched the blood on my ear. He saw my pants undone, hanging off my hips.
What happened?
Were you attacked again?
Miss Ferraci asked. She guided me to a quieter spot behind the roasted nuts tent. The smell made me want to vomit. Diego followed us, his eyes an expressionless wasteland.
Henry, tell me what happened.
Miss Ferraci grabbed her cell phone out of her purse.
That's it. I'm calling an ambulance.
It was Marcus McCoy. Miss Ferraci dialed 911.
What was Marcus?
Diego's voice was flat. He hardly sounded like the boy I knew.
I need an ambulance and police at Calypso High School. One of our students has been attacked.
Miss Ferraci regarded me like she was afraid I was going to shatter to pieces in front of her.
What did Marcus do?
I couldn't look Diego in the eyes.
It's not your problem.
Did Marcus hurt you?
I nodded.
Did he?
Diego glanced at my jeans, and I fumbled with them but couldn't button them because my wrist was swollen and useless.
He tried.
Diego's mouth twisted. Miss Ferraci touched my shoulder and I jumped.
It's okay, Henry. You're okay. The police are coming. Let's get you somewhere safe.
She put her arm around my shoulders to lead me toward the school.
Come on, Diego, I said.
But Diego was gone. I sat on the back of an ambulance while the cops questioned me, and paramedics pressed gauze to my head. My wrist was definitely broken, and I probably had a concussion. I told the police officers everything, including who had attacked me in the showers. The paramedics wanted to take me to the hospital, but I refused to go until someone found Diego. Audrey stayed with me, holding my good hand. She hardly said a word. A crowd of onlookers had gathered around the emergency vehicles, and my mom shoved them aside to get to me, not caring who she elbowed.
Henry! Henry! What the hell happened?
She was wearing pink pajamas and her hair was pulled back with an elastic band. I smiled weakly and tried to assure her I was okay, but what she really needed was a Xanax.
Someone attacked me, I said. He tried to
rape me. None of this would have happened if I hadn't run from Diego. I needed to be alone, so I went to the football field.
Young man, said the red-haired paramedic with bloodshot eyes, we need to take you to the hospital.
Not until they find Diego,
I turned to Audrey.
You have to find him.
I am not leaving you. Her voice was so fierce that I didn't even try to argue. The paramedic was about to explain for the fifth time why I needed to go to the emergency room when two cops led Diego through the crowd, his hand zip-tied behind his back. Dried blood stained his face and was streaked across his shirt. I jumped off the edge of the ambulance and ran to him.
Diego, are you okay?
I looked for the source of the blood but couldn't find any injuries.
Don't worry, Diego said. It's not mine.
16 January, 2016. We stayed at the emergency room until nearly 2 a.m. A chatty doctor put 4 stitches in my scalp and a cast on my wrist. When we got home, I passed out on the couch with my phone beside my head so I wouldn't miss it when Diego returned one of the 100 texts or voicemails I'd left for him. I just needed to know he was okay. Audrey messaged me that Marcus had been released to his parents, who immediately checked him into a drug and alcohol treatment facility. Mom peeked in on me repeatedly throughout the night. At around 8 in the morning, I sat up and said, "I'm not sleeping." With a cup of coffee in one hand and an unlit cigarette in the other, Mom sat beside me on the couch. She fidgeted with the cigarette like she was dying to put it to her lips and light it, and didn't seem to know what she was supposed to be doing. Finally, she set the mug on the coffee table and hugged me so tightly that I thought she was trying to break my spine.
"Why didn't you tell me it had gotten so bad?"
"You needed me to be okay."
"I didn't know."
Mom hugged me again, and this time I hugged her back. I tried to be strong. I tried to hold myself together, but I couldn't do it anymore. I told her everything, about the sluggers and the end of the world and the button and Marcus and my guilt over Jesse's suicide. "It's my fault Diego's in trouble," I said. "All of this is my fault." I expected my mom to tell me that it wasn't my fault and that nothing was broken we couldn't mend, but there were lines on her face I'd never seen before, like she'd aged a decade overnight.
"Tell me why you didn't press the button."
"Who cares about the button, Mom? Diego's in jail because of me. This is important, Henry."
"Mom!"
"Henry." Mom's bottom lip trembled.
"Do you wish you were dead?"
"We slammed doors in my family. We beat each other up, and we asked questions we didn't want answers to, and we wielded silence like a dagger." I wasn't sure how to respond to her blunt honesty except with honesty of my own. "I don't want to die, but I don't want to live either. I don't know why anyone would. This world is so fucked up, Mom. I think we'd all be better off if I didn't press the button. Everything just hurts too much. And I miss Jesse, and I tried to be okay. I thought Marcus could help me forget, and Diego could replace Jesse, but I miss him so much." Mom was quiet for a long time. Her silence stretched across the morning and led me back through the past 100 days. And I knew what she was going to say before she finally said it.
"I think you need help, Henry."
"I don't need help."
"Then answer me truthfully. Are you okay?"
I was confused and woozy from the pain medication. I didn't have time for doctors or therapists. I needed to know what was happening with Diego. He was still on probation, and I didn't know what being arrested for beating up Marcus would mean for him. All I had to do was tell my mom I was okay, and she'd believe me. I could go to the police station and explain everything. All I had to do was say 3 little words and I could fix all that I'd broken. But I was broken too. And I didn't know how to fix myself. I'm not okay. 19 January, 2016. Miranda, one of the moons belonging to Uranus, features a patchwork of ridges and cliffs, grooved structures called coronae, and massive canyons up to 12 times deeper than the Grand Canyon. Some scientists have theorized that Miranda's piecemeal structure is the result of a massive impact that broke the moon into several pieces that, held together by her gravity, were reformed into something entirely unique. I feel as broken as Miranda, but I can't begin to guess at what's holding me together. Audrey and I walked through what passed for a garden at the Quiet Oaks inpatient treatment facility. Most of the plants were stunted or dead, and cigarette butts poked out of the dirt like signposts.
There wasn't much for the patients to do between therapy sessions other than smoke or write or fuck with the nurses. You should see what happens when I try to take a pudding cup out of the kitchen. One step off the linoleum and Katie starts screaming about breaking the rules. That sets Matthew off. All he ever does is drone on and on about how cruel we are to eat in front of him, and I have to wear socks around Brandy or she tries to molest my feet. Sounds fun? Audrey laughed. I wondered if the hospital she'd been at was like mine, and if she'd been afraid they'd never let her leave. It's really not. Nurse Curtis watched us from the door to make sure Audrey wasn't sneaking me contraband. They took my shaving razors and my shoelaces. The only thing I was allowed to keep was a pencil so I could keep writing in my journal. Are you doing better? Better was such a relative word. I wasn't even sure what the baseline to measure better against was. Dr. Janeway put me on antidepressants. They take time to work, I guess. I think she wants me to let Jesse go, but I haven't figured out how I'm supposed to do that yet. Audrey sat on one of the faded plastic patio chairs, and I sat across from her. Is that progress? I don't know. I mean, how am I supposed to say goodbye to Jesse? You don't, Audrey said. Not really. I shook my head. Dr. Janeway and I talk about the aliens a lot. Jesse, too. Sometimes we talk about Marcus, but I don't really like to, and she's cool about not pushing me. Speaking of Marcus, Principal DeShields expelled him. Seriously? Without any concrete evidence, the police were reluctant to charge him with attempted rape. It didn't matter how many times I repeated my story to the cops. They couldn't hide their skepticism. Marcus was right. No one believed loser space boys. But it didn't matter. I'd made a choice. Audrey's tentative smile morphed into a grin. The police searched him and found a handful of OxyContin in his pocket. Since he was on school grounds, that was all the excuse DeShields needed to give him the boot. I hope he gets help. I hope he gets what's coming to him. He probably wouldn't. He'd probably still get into a good college, end up rich like his parents, and have everything he thought he ever wanted. But it was like Ms. Ferraci had said, Marcus didn't matter to me. Have you heard from Diego? Audrey hesitated, and I knew she had. Mom had driven me to his house on our way to Quiet Oaks the morning after the winter carnival, but he hadn't been home. I'd left a note on his front door, begging him to call Audrey or Charlie or my mom, but it had been 3 days and he hadn't called. I even used the calling card Marcus had given me and called Viviana from the hospital, but she hadn't answered. He's in Colorado. My heart was beating so hard I thought it would explode. Is he... His sister's with him. He's got to go before a judge for violating his probation, but since Marcus's family isn't pressing charges, he's hopeful the judge will be lenient. I raised my eyebrow. Marcus isn't pressing charges? Diego broke his nose. Don't forget about the tooth, Audrey chuckled. Their darling boy tried to rape another boy at a high school carnival. It's not the sort of thing his parents want to draw attention to. Did Diego give you a number? The hospital had a payphone for patients to use, and I wanted to call him so badly. I didn't expect things to go back to the way they were, but I was hoping he'd still be my friend. Audrey shook her head. I'd figured as much. Even though Diego had risked being locked up in juvie for me, I wasn't sure I could fix the damage I'd done. Just focus on getting better, Henry. That's what's important. 21 January, 2016. On my fifth day in Quiet Oaks, Dr. Janeway took me on a field trip. It was my idea, but she agreed without hesitation. It was one of those nice Florida days that make you forget about the months of steamy air teeming with blood-hungry mosquitoes. A salty breeze blew in from the ocean, and it was cool even in the sunlight. Dr. Janeway remained in her car, giving me enough distance to feel like I was on my own. Jesse Franklin's headstone was simple and uncomplicated. I think maybe people thought that's how Jesse was, but there was so much under the surface that no one, not even I, knew about. I wish I had. Now that I'm here, I don't know what to say. I stood over Jesse's grave, my hands folded in front of me. Apparently, letting the world end is sort of the same as wanting to kill myself, so I guess I'm just as screwed up as you. It hurt to imagine Jesse all alone under the ground. I wasn't sure whether I believed in heaven or hell or reincarnation. All I knew was that Jesse was gone and that I'd loved him. Dr. Janeway says I'll never really know why you